Detective. May slides into June, which slides into July, which creeps toward August. Because of the heat, I've had intense dreams the last 4 nights about vivisection, and I'm doing nothing now, vegetating in my office with a sickening headache and a Walkman with a soothing Kenny G CD playing in it, but the bright mid-morning sunlight floods the room, piercing my skull, causing my hangover to throb, and because of this, there's no workout this morning. Listening to the music, I notice the second light on my phone blinking off and on, which means that Jean is buzzing me. I sigh and carefully remove the Walkman. "What is it?" I ask in monotone.
"Patrick,"
she begins. "Yes, Jean?" I ask condescendingly, spacing the two words out.
"Patrick, a Mr. Donald Kimball is here to see you,"
she says nervously.
"Who?"
I snap, distracted. She emits a small sigh of worry, then, as if asking, lowers her voice.
"Detective Donald Kimball?"
I pause, staring out the window into sky, then at my monitor, then at the headless woman I've been doodling on the back cover of this week's Sports Illustrated, and I run my hand over the glossy finish of the magazine once, twice, before tearing the cover off and crumpling it up. Finally, I start, "Tell him..." Then mulling it over, rethinking my options, I stop and begin again. "Tell him I'm at lunch." Jean pauses, then whispers,
"Patrick, I think he knows you're here."
During my protracted silence, she adds, still hushed,
"It's 10:30.
I sigh, stalling again, and in a contained panic tell Jean, "Send him in, I guess." I stand up, walk over to the Jody mirror that hangs next to the George Stubbs painting, and check my hair, running an oxhorn comb through it. Then calmly I pick up one of my cordless phones, and preparing myself for a tense scene, pretend to be talking with John Akers, and I start enunciating clearly into the phone before the detective enters the office. "Now, John," I clear my throat, "you've got to wear clothes in proportion to your physique," I begin, talking to nobody. "There are definitely do's and don'ts, good buddy, of wearing a bold striped shirt. A bold striped shirt calls for solid-colored or discreetly patterned suits and ties." The door to the office opens, and I wave in the detective, who is surprisingly young, maybe my age, wearing a linen Armani suit not unlike mine, though his is slightly disheveled in a hip way, which worries me. I offer a reassuring smile. "And a shirt with a high yarn count means it's more durable than one that doesn't." "Yes, I know. But to determine this, you've got to examine the material's weave." I point to the Mark Schrager chrome and teak chair on the opposite side of my desk, silently urging him to sit. "Tightly woven fabric is created not only by using a lot of yarn, but by using yarn of high-quality fibers, both long and thin, which fabricate a close weave as opposed to short and stubby fibers, like those found in tweed. And loosely woven fabrics, such as knits, are extremely delicate and should be treated with great care." Because of the detective's arrival, it seems unlikely that this will be a good day, and I eye him warily as he takes the seat and crosses his legs in a way that fills me with a nameless dread. I realize I've been quiet too long when he turns around to see if I'm off the phone. "Right, and..." "Yes, John, right, and..." "Yes. Always tip the stylist 15%. I pause. "No, the owner of the salon shouldn't be tipped." I shrug at the detective hopelessly, rolling my eyes. He nods, smiles understandingly, and recrosses his legs. "Nice socks. Jesus. The girl who washes the hair. It depends. I'd say a dollar or two." I laugh. "Depends on what she looks like." I laugh harder. "And yeah, what else she washes." I pause again, then say, "Listen, John, I've got to go. T. Boone Pickens just walked in." I pause, grinning like an idiot, then laugh. "Just joking." Another pause.
No, don't tip the owner of the salon. I laugh once more, then finally, okay, John. Right. Got it. I hang up the phone, push its antenna down, and then, uselessly stressing my normality, say, I'm sorry about that. No, I'm sorry, he says, genuinely apologetic. I should have made an appointment. Gesturing toward the cordless phone I'm placing back in its rechargeable cradle, he asks, was that, anything important? Oh, that, I ask, moving toward my desk, sinking into my chair, just mulling over business problems, examining opportunities, exchanging rumors, spreading gossip. We both laugh. The ice breaks. Hi, he says, sitting up, holding out his hand. I'm Donald Kimball. Hi, Pat Bateman. I take it, squeezing it firmly. Nice to meet you. I'm sorry, he says, to barge in on you like this, but I was supposed to talk to Lewis Carruthers, and he wasn't in, and, well, you're here, so. He smiles, shrugs. I know how busy you guys can get. He averts his eyes from the three copies of Sports Illustrated that lie open atop my desk, covering it along with the Walkman. I notice them, too, then close all three issues, and slip them into the desk top drawer along with the still-running Walkman. So, I start, trying to come off as friendly and conversational as possible, what's the topic of discussion? Well, he starts, I've been hired by Meredith Powell to investigate the disappearance of Paul Owen. I nod thoughtfully before asking, you're not with the FBI or anything, are you? No, no, he says, nothing like that. I'm just a private investigator. Ah, I see. Yes. I nod again, still not relieved. Paul's disappearance. Yes. So it's nothing that official, he confides. I just have some basic questions. About Paul Owen. About yourself. Coffee? I ask suddenly. As if unsure, he says, no, I'm okay. Perrier? San Pellegrino? I offer. No, I'm okay, he says again, opening a small black notebook he's taken out of his pocket, along with a gold cross pen. I buzz Jean. Yes, Patrick? Jean, can you bring Mr. I stop, look up. He looks up, too. Kimball. Mr. Kimball, a bottle of San Pella. Oh, no, I'm okay. He protests. It's no problem, I tell him. I get the feeling he's trying not to stare at me strangely. He turns back to his notebook and writes something down, then crosses something out. Jean walks in almost immediately, and she places the bottle of San Pellegrino and a Steuben-etched glass tumbler on my desk in front of Kimball. She gives me a fretful, worried glance, which I scowl at. Kimball looks up, smiles, and nods at Jean, who I notice is not wearing a bra today. Innocently, I watch her leave, then return my gaze to Kimball, clasping my hands together, sitting up. Well, what's the topic of discussion, I say again. The disappearance of Paul Owen, he says, reminding me. Oh, right, well, I haven't heard anything about the disappearance or anything. I pause, then try to laugh, not on page six at least. Kimball smiles politely. I think his family wants this kept quiet. Understandable. I nod at the untouched glass and bottle, and then look up at him. Lime? No, really, he says. I'm okay. You sure? I ask. I can always get you a lime. He pauses briefly, then says, just some preliminary questions that I need to ask for my own files, okay? Shoot, I say. How old are you? He asks. 27, I say. I'll be 28 in October. Where did you go to school? He scribbles something in his book. Harvard, I tell him. Then Harvard Business School. Your address? He asks, looking only at his book. 55 West 81st Street, I say. The American Gardens building. Nice. He looks up, impressed. Very nice. Thanks. I smile. Flattered. Doesn't Tom Cruise live there? He asks. Yep. I squeeze the bridge of my nose. Suddenly, I have to close my eyes tightly. I hear him speak. Pardon me, but are you okay? Opening my eyes, both of them tearing, I say, why do you ask? You seem nervous. I reach into a drawer in my desk and bring out a bottle of aspirin. Nuprin, I offer. Kimball looks at the bottle strangely, then back at me before shaking his head. No thanks. He's taken out a pack of Marlboros and absently lays it next to the San Pellegrino bottle while studying something in the book. Bad habit, I point out. He looks up and, noticing my disapproval, smiles sheepishly. I know. I'm sorry. I stare at the box. Would you rather I not smoke? He asks, tentatively. I continue to stare at the cigarette pack, debating. No, I guess it's okay. You sure? No problem. I buzz Jean. Yes, Patrick? Bring us an ashtray for Mr. Kimball, please, I say. In a matter of seconds, she does. What can you tell me about Paul Owen? He finally asks, after Jean leaves. Having placed a fortune off crystal ashtray on the desk next to the untouched San Pellegrino. Well, I cough, swallowing two Nuprin dry. I didn't know him that well. How well did you know him? He asks. I'm at a loss, I tell him, somewhat truthfully. He was part of that whole Yale thing, you know. Yale thing? He asks, confused. I pause, having no idea what I'm talking about. Yeah. Yale thing. What do you mean, Yale thing? Now he's intrigued. I pause again. What do I mean? Well, I think for one that he was probably a closet homosexual. I have no idea. Doubt it, considering his taste in babes. Who did a lot of cocaine. I pause, then add, a bit shakily, that Yale thing. I'm sure I say this bizarrely, but there's no other way to put it. It's very quiet in the office right now. The room suddenly seems cramped and sweltering, and even though the air conditioning is on full blast, the air seems fake, recycled. So, Kimball looks at his book helplessly. There's nothing you can tell me about Paul Owen. Well, I sigh. He led what I suppose was an orderly life, I guess. Really stumped, I offer. He ate a balanced diet. I'm sensing frustration on Kimball's part, and he asks, what kind of man was he? Besides, he falters, tries to smile, the information you've just given. How could I describe Paul Owen to this guy? Boasting, arrogant, cheerful dickhead who constantly weaseled his way out of checks at Nell's? That I'm heir to the unfortunate information that his penis had a name, and that name was Michael? No, calmer Bateman. I think that I'm smiling. I hope I'm not being cross-examined here, I manage to say. Do you feel that way? He asks. The question sounds sinister, but isn't. No, I say carefully, not really. Maddeningly, he writes something else down, then asks, without looking up, chewing on the tip of the pen, where did Paul hang out? Hang out, I ask. Yeah, he says, you know, hang out. Let me think, I say, tapping my fingers across my desk. The Newport, Harry's, Flutie's, Andosheen, Nell's, Cornell Club, the New York Yacht Club, the regular places. Kimball looks confused. He had a yacht? Stuck, I casually say, no, he just hang out there. And where did he go to school? He asks. I pause. Don't you know this? I just wanted to know if you know, he says without looking up. Yale, I say slowly. Right? Right. And then to business school at Columbia, I add. I think. Before all that, he asks, if I remember correctly, St. Paul's, No, it's okay. That's not really important. He apologizes. I just have no other questions, I guess. I don't have a lot to go on. Listen, I start softly, tactfully. I just want to help. I understand, he says. Another long pause. He marks something down, but it doesn't seem important. Anything else you can tell me about Owen? He asks, sounding almost timid. I think about it, then feebly announce. We were both 7 in 1969. Kimball smiles. So was I. Pretending to be interested in the case, I ask, do you have any witnesses or fingerprints? He cuts me off, tiredly. Well, there's a message on his answering machine saying he went to London. Well, I ask then, hopefully. Maybe he did, huh? His girlfriend doesn't think so, Kimball says tonelessly. Without even beginning to understand, I imagine what a speck Paul Owen was in the overall enormity of things. But, I stop. Has anyone seen him in London? Kimball looks at his book, flips over a page, and then, looking back at me, says, actually, yes. I say. Well, I've had a hard time getting an accurate verification, he admits. Stephen Hughes says he saw him at a restaurant there, but I checked it out. And what happened is he mistook a Hubert Ainsworth for Paul, so... Oh, I say. Do you remember where you were on the night of Paul's disappearance? He checks his book, which was on the 24th of June. Gosh, I guess... I think about it. I was probably returning videotapes. I open my desk drawer, take out my date book, and looking through December, announce, I had a date with a girl named Veronica. I'm completely lying, totally making this up. Wait, he says, confused, looking at his book. That's not what I've got. My thigh muscles tense. What? That's not the information I've received, he says. Well, I'm suddenly confused and scared, the Neupren bitter in my stomach. Wait, what information have you received? Let's see. He flips through his pad, finds something. That you were with... Wait. I laugh. I could be wrong. My spine feels damp. Well, he stops. When was the last time you were with Paul Owen? He asks. We had... Oh, my God, Bateman, think up something. Gone to a new musical that had just opened called Oh, Africa, Brave Africa. A gulp. It was a laugh riot. That's about it. I think we had dinner at Orso's. No, Petaluma. No, Orso's. I stop. The last time I physically saw him was at an automated teller. I can't remember which. Just one that was near Nell's. But the night he disappeared? Kimball asks. I'm not really sure, I say. I think maybe you've got your dates mixed up, he says, glancing at his book. But how? I ask. Where do you place Paul that night? According to his date book, and this was verified by his secretary, he had dinner with Marcus Halberstam, he says. And? I ask. I've questioned him. Marcus? Yes. And he denies it, Kimball says, though at first he couldn't be sure. But Marcus denied it? Yes. Well, does Marcus have an alibi? I have a heightened receptivity to his answers now. Yes. Pause. He does? I ask. You're sure? I checked it out, he says with an odd smile. It's clean. Pause. Oh. Now, where were you? He laughs. I laugh too, though I'm not sure why. Where was Marcus? I'm almost giggling. Kimball keeps smiling as he looks over at me. He wasn't with Paul Owen, he says enigmatically. So, who was he with? I'm laughing still, but I'm also very dizzy. Kimball opens his book and for the first time gives me a slightly hostile look. He was at Atlantis with Craig McDermott, Frederick Dibble, Harry Newman, George Butner, and... Kimball pauses, then looks up. You. In this office right now, I am thinking about how long it would take a corpse to disintegrate right in this office. In this office, these are the things I fantasize about while dreaming. Eating ribs at Red Hot and Blue in Washington, D.C. If I should switch shampoos, what really is the best dry beer? Is Bill Robinson an overrated designer? What's wrong with IBM? Ultimate luxury. Is the term playing hardball an adverb? The fragile piece of Assisi. Electric light. The epitome of luxury. Of ultimate luxury. The bastard's wearing the same damn Armani linen suit I've got on. How easy it would be to scare the living wits out of this fucking guy. Kimball is utterly unaware of how truly vacant I am. There is no evidence of animate life in this office. Yet still he takes notes. By the time you finish reading the sentence, a Boeing jetliner will take off or land somewhere in the world. I would like a Pilsner Urquell. Oh, right, I say, of course. We had wanted Paul Owen to come, I say, nodding my head as if just realizing something, but he said he had plans. Then, lamely, I guess I had dinner with Victoria the following night. Listen, like I said, I was just hired by Meredith. He sighs, closing his book. Tentatively, I ask, did you know that Meredith Powell is dating Brock Thompson? He shrugs, sighs. I don't know about that. All I know is that Paul Owen owes her supposedly a lot of money. Oh, I say, nodding. Really? Personally, he says, confiding, I think the guy went a little nutso. Split town for a while. Maybe he did go to London. Sightseeing, drinking, whatever. Anyway, I'm pretty sure he'll turn up sooner or later. I nod slowly, hoping to look suitably bewildered. Was he involved at all, do you think, in, say, occultism or Satan worship? Kimball asks seriously. What? I know it sounds like a lame question, but in New Jersey last month, I don't know if you've heard about this, but a young stockbroker was recently arrested and charged with murdering a young Chicano girl and performing voodoo rituals with, well, various body parts. Yikes! I exclaim. And I mean, he smiles sheepishly again. Have you heard anything about this? Did the guy deny doing it? I ask, tingling. Right. Kimball nods. That was an interesting case, I manage to say. Even though the guy says he's innocent, he still thinks he's Inca, the bird god or something, Kimball says, scrunching his features up. We both laugh out loud about this. No, I finally say. Paul wasn't into that. He followed a balanced diet and, yeah, I know, and was into that whole Yale thing, Kimball finishes tiredly. There was a long pause that I think might be the longest one so far. Have you consulted a psychic? I ask. No. He shakes his head in a way that suggests he's considered it. Oh, who cares? Had his apartment been burglarized? I ask. No, it actually hadn't, he says. Toiletries were missing. The suit was gone. So was some luggage. That's it. You suspect foul play? Can't say, he says. But like I told you, I wouldn't be surprised if he's just hiding out someplace. I mean, no one's dealing with the homicide squad yet or anything, right? I ask. No, not yet. As I said, we're not sure, but... He stops, looks dejected. Basically, no one has seen or heard anything. That's so typical, isn't it? I ask. It's just strange, he agrees, staring out the window, lost. One day, someone's walking around, going to work, alive, And then Kimball stops, fails to complete the sentence.
Nothing,
I sigh, nodding. People just disappear, he says.
The earth just opens up and swallows people, I say, somewhat sadly, checking my Rolex.
Eerie, Kimball yawns, stretching.
Really eerie.
Ominous. I nod my agreement.
It's just, he sighs, exasperated. Futile.
I pause, unsure of what to say, and come up with,
futility is hard to deal with.
I am thinking about nothing. It's silent in the office. To break it, I point out a book on top of the desk, next to the San Pellegrino bottle. The Art of the Deal by Donald Trump.
Have you read it? I ask Kimball.
No, he sighs, but politely asks, is it any good?
It's very good, I say, nodding.
Listen, he sighs again. I've taken up enough of your time.
He pockets the Marlboros.
I have a lunch meeting with Cliff Huxtable at the Four Seasons in 20 minutes anyway, I lie, standing up. I have to go, too.
Isn't the Four Seasons a little far uptown?
He looks concerned, also getting up. I mean, aren't you going to be late?
No, I stall. There's one down here.
Oh, really? He asks. I didn't know that.
Yes, I say, leading him to the door. It's very good.
Listen, he says, turning to face me, if anything occurs to you, any information at all, I hold up a hand.
Absolutely, I'm 100% with you, I say solemnly.
Great, the ineffectual one says, relieved.
And thanks for your time, Mr. Bateman.
Moving him toward the door, my legs wobbly, astronaut-like, leading him out of the office. Though I'm empty, devoid of feeling, I still sense, without deluding myself, that I've accomplished something, and then, anticlimactically, we talk for a few minutes more about razor burn bombs and Tattersall shirts. There was an odd general lack of urgency to the conversation that I found soothing. Nothing happened at all. But when he smiles, hands me his card, leaves, the door closing sounds to me like a billion insects screaming, pounds of bacon sizzling, a vast emptiness. And after he leaves the building, I have Gene buzz Tom at security to make sure, I call someone recommended by my lawyer to make sure none of my phones are wiretapped, and after a Xanax, I'm able to meet with my nutritionist at an expensive upscale health food restaurant called Cuisine de Soy in Tribeca. And while sitting beneath the dolphin, stuffed and shellacked, that hangs over the tofu bar, its body bent into an arc, I'm able to ask the nutritionist questions like, okay, so give me the muffin lowdown, without cringing. Back at the office 2 hours later, I found out that none of my phones are tapped. I also run into Meredith Powell later this week, on Friday night, at Eray's, with Brock Thompson. And though we talk for 10 minutes, mostly about why neither of us is in the Hamptons, with Brock glaring at me the entire time, she doesn't mention Paul Owen once. I'm having an excruciatingly slow dinner with my date, Jeanette. The restaurant is flashy and new, and the meal inches along, drags by. The portions are meager. I grow increasingly agitated. Afterwards, I want to bypass MK, even though Jeanette complains because she wants to dance. I'm tired, need to rest. At my apartment, I lie in bed, too distracted to have sex with her, so she leaves. And I'm watching a tape of this morning's Patty Winter show, which is about the best restaurants in the Middle East. I pick up my cordless phone and tentatively, reluctantly, call Evelyn.